Well, good to be hanging out with you. We're going to be, as I mentioned here in the book of Matthew, we're going to be in chapter 14 in connection with our spiritual formation series. We've been talking a lot about what it means to grow spiritually, trying to put really some framework to it, recognizing the ambiguity that can surround it, and just trying to give us a clear finish line, a clear North Star of what it means to really grow in Christ. And just by way of quick introduction, I don't want to bore you with a repetition of a message we've already given, but the whole spiritual life, as we've been learning, starts with the heart. It really starts with being humbly submitted to God in every area of our life, and then it moves there to our minds of being biblically formed. Those two form what we would call the core. Everything comes back to the core. This is a good way of checking yourself, as if you find yourself living like a knucklehead, chances are you can come back to the core and realize that that's where the problem lies. It's typically not in behavior. Behavior modification is religion. That's not what the Bible teaches. Heart change is what the Bible teaches. So if you find yourself living crazy, or if you find yourself short-tempered, or if you find yourself snapping, or if you find yourself, you know, having a tendency to have wayward eyes, if you find yourself in the peripheral of life living outside of what God would intend, go back to the core. Submit your heart to Him. Let His Word shape you. It's such a healthy thing to just come back to the source of life, and that's Jesus and Jesus alone. Now, once you cultivate that heart, what you're going to find, though, is that it's going to begin to spill out. And so we get to have a little bit of fun in our time together talking about what it means for this spiritual life to begin to move from what God is doing in us to what God is now doing through us. I don't know if you realize this or not, but God actually called you to Himself that you might make a difference in your world. God called you to Himself that we would be, dysfunctional as we are, light. That we would be hope. That we would be breaths of fresh air to a parched world. That we would be living water to people as God lives through us. That we would be a blessing to those around. That's what God intended for us. Now, the reality is we sometimes fall short of what God has called us to be. The good news is, and we've mentioned it before, it's really not how you start, it's how you finish. And so let's find where we're at, do some honest assessment, but consider what might be for us, what could be for us in terms of living our faith for Christ. And we're going to talk about one of the sectors. There's three of them. And so we'll talk about one of them here together tonight. And it's the idea of being sacrificially generous. And the idea of being sacrificially generous is really the concept of considering generosity or generous stewardship of your time and of your talents and of your treasures, and allowing God to stir in you a greater awareness of the fact that what we have is truly His and He's entrusted them to us. And if we will live sacrificially generous, it will begin to spill over into the world around, and we've called that being an intentional blessing. The idea would be seeing the opportunity to distribute these resources of time, talent, and treasure to the community around, or for the betterment or benefit of others. If we're not careful, the spiritual life becomes a very self-centered thing. It's about me and my and I, and it's about my this, and you know, it becomes very inward focused. And I want to just kind of lean into that a little bit and say, okay, that's not necessarily what God intended, but being others-focused is very painful, because before you can be others-focused, you have to break up with yourself. And so I want to lean into that, because I think part of the process here is getting out into the world around us and really allowing Christ to reign through us. This kind of concept of being generous is a very countercultural thing. Generosity is unnatural. Have you noticed that? I mean, those of you who have kids, we've laughed about this before, you don't have to teach a kid to be selfish. Somehow they pick that up intuitively. It's amazing. You don't have to teach them to be defiant. They've already figured that out when they look at you and they go, no. They're not even knee high. No. It's like, what did you just say? I'm going to have to beat you to death for saying that. You know what I mean? You just I would never beat a kid to death. Never. But you know what I mean? It's natural to be selfish, and yet when you look at the biblical picture, you just see God's people living differently. Like, just casually read the book of Acts chapter 2 and just watch what they did. These people who were celebrating at the Feast of Pentecost, all kinds of worshipers had come in to hang out with them, so they're couch surfing in their homes, and they run out of food, and the Spirit of God has now come and indwelt the disciples and those gathered in the upper room, and they're now sharing the gospel with these people, and people are coming to Christ. It says, in fact, 3,000 people came to Christ. God started a mega church right off the bat. So, you know, we can make fun of mega churches, and I'm probably first in the line to poke fun at it, but God started one right off the bat, and yet you see these people then beginning to demonstrate their genuineness of their faith by their generosity. So they're literally selling their rent houses and taking the money and bringing it to those who had need. And that's upper division spirituality. Like, you start talking about that kind of generosity, and you're not messing around in Sunday school anymore. Have you noticed that? Like, you can give lordship of your life to the Lord in a lot of areas, but typically that area of stuff, things, resources, we tend to hang on to. But it is unnatural, because the tendency is to say that this is my time. My time is mine, and my talents are mine, and my treasures are mine, because we've bought in subtly to the lie that greed leads to life. See, we think that. We would never maybe admit that publicly, but we really, especially in our culture, have kind of come to the place where we've bought into that. Yeah, greed leads to life, and so it's mine. And it's he who dies with the most toys wins, and it's keeping up with the whoevers, and it's that accumulation lifestyle. And really, we've just followed in the path of Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3, who were so completely obsessed with what they didn't have that they didn't see the incredible blessing that God had already given them. You ever notice that? I mean, kids are like that, and truthfully, adults are just kids wearing big girl and big boy clothes. Because we tend to do the same thing. We don't focus on what we have. We focus on what we don't have. And, you know, in that concept, what ends up happening is we become so focused on what's not here and so focused on what we want and what we don't have that we obsess about stupid things. Stupid things. Like clothes. Shoes. Purses. Is that too convicting for some of you, purses? I'm sorry, I should have said something else. We obsess about the right car and the right house and the right, and we obsess about all these things. And when Jesus came and he spoke in the Sermon on the Mount, he addressed it and he just said, look, why don't you just seek first my kingdom and my righteousness? Because that's where true happiness is going to be anyway. You know, the irony is, I don't know how many of you know people that are very affluent who've, like, I don't know, won the lotto or, I don't know, done something awesome and made a ton of money. But the complexity level rises with the income. It really does. And so, yeah, they make a ton of money, but now they're paying two mortgages because they had to have that house in Aspen, you know, and they got four cars, and I mean, everything now just gets complicated. And I guess the point with that is, as you look at it, you begin to see the reality check that excess doesn't bring joy. Selfishness does not bring peace. Obsession with stuff does not bring rest. And selfish accumulation, it just doesn't satisfy. I mean, that's the reality. Now, the difficulty is I feel like as a culture, we're all salmon trying to swim upstream. We're just kind of bumping into each other, frantic, you know, I gotta, you know, my kid's a six-year-old, but I gotta get her a scholarship. How about go buy her a box of crayons, you know? Just let her be a kid, but we're fighting all the time for what's next, what's next, what's next, what's next. And the biblical truth seems to be that life is found when we give it away. In fact, Jesus just made the statement in Matthew chapter 10. He said, he who has found his life will lose it. And he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. One of the things I hope to do in our time together is to encourage you to give your life away. Just give it away, because you'll never regret it. To take your time, to take your talents, to take your treasures, and just give them away shamelessly to the glory of God. And in so doing, find that elusive pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that we've all longed for, and that is peace and rest and satisfaction and purpose. That don't come, none of those things come from a bigger paycheck. None of them come from a cooler car. None of them come from the perfect pair of jeans. It comes when you give your life away. Well, that's the model, ultimately, that I think Jesus left for us. And so as we've talked about this series, we've always wanted to go back to Jesus. And so I want to get there. If you've got your Bibles, turn to Matthew 14. We're going to look at a passage here in a second that I think demonstrates his ability to be generous with life, enough to give it all away. If you were to just take the Gospels and just look at the four Gospels and survey the life of Christ, there's several categories of the way that Jesus demonstrated incredible generosity. One was in his teaching, of course. I mean, he taught in his parables about the Good Samaritan or the rich fool, always kind of pushing on the accumulation concept and really promoting a generous lifestyle. He talked about principles like your heart will follow your treasures. So whatever it is that is really of value to you, your heart will go there with it. He talked, of course, about the teaching of being humble, where the last will be first and the first will be last. All of the teaching of Jesus seems to be that countercultural teaching that encourages us to live differently and to give our lives away. The second thing I think, though, as you look at the life of Christ that models this concept of generosity, was the healings that he did. I don't know about you, I feel pretty busy in life sometimes, you know. I was joking with somebody, I'm like, I think I know what today is, you know, and that's about as far ahead as I can get. And I just get the feeling Jesus was to the wall even more. Like if you consider the people he interacted with, even in the passage we're going to look at, constantly bombarded with people, and yet he was healing them. He would heal a leper, heal a blind man, heal a person who was disabled, spend time ministering to people that were in a bad way, even Lazarus who was dead. I mean, just generosity of just being present and giving his life away. And I think the other thing was his own life, just the example. And obviously the death of Christ, is there any greater example of a sacrificially generous move that was a blessing intentionally to the multitudes? There's probably no greater thing we could talk about than that. But he gave away his time. Up early, out on the lake with the boys, late nights, exhausted walks, needy crowds. I mean, he just spent a ton of time with people giving his life away. And I think the key, as I look at all of these verses, the key to understanding the real generosity of Jesus is in one word. The word in English is the word compassion. Compassion. It's a word that's a unique word for us, though. When I say compassion, I want to make sure we understand the biblical definition. It was compassion that Jesus told his listeners that they should have had, like the Good Samaritan had. It was compassion that the prodigal son's father had. It was compassion that Jesus said he felt moved because the people were sheep without a shepherd, and he felt compassion. It's used 12 times in the Gospels. And of those 12 times, it refers to a feeling of great affection or love. It literally has the idea of from the bowels. The concept would be where you are so moved, you are so wrecked inside, that it is forcing you to action. That, I think, is the key to the life of Christ and his generosity. His life was defined by compassion, not pity. Pity is where you feel bad, but you don't do anything. Compassion is where you're moved to participate. And I think it's that compassion that he begins to show us here in Matthew 14. If you've got your Bible, look at verse 13. It's a very familiar passage for those of you who may have been around the things of God for a while. It's the feeding of the 5,000. And I want to look at it because as I was thinking about this message, I thought, man, this is interesting. Because he uses this as an incredible discipleship moment to shape his disciples that are with him. He uses them to teach them the lesson of a message that we capture in the book of Acts chapter 20. But you don't see in any of the Gospels, but it's quoted that Jesus would say that it's more blessed to give than to receive. And so it's that message that he's trying to show his disciples, who, if you remember reading through the Gospel accounts, were very fascinated with the concept of him establishing his kingdom. Are you going to set up your kingdom? And if you do, can I sit on your right and on your left? And when you do, can we reign with you? And we're going to be like on the inside track. You get the feeling that for these guys, it was really more about them than about other people. They didn't understand compassion yet. This is a teaching point Jesus will use. I think also this lesson of the feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle captured in all four Gospels. So of prime importance that each guy captures this thing. And I think it begins to reveal the state of heart of where the disciples really were. Because as you read through the passage, you'll find that they're saying, hey, what about me? hey, why should I help them? And even, what do I even have to offer? Now, I don't know how you feel when I say, hey, God's called you to be generous with what you've got, but chances are you go through that same thing. You're like, yeah, but what about me? And if I give it away, what am I going to have? Yeah, and why should I help them? Why shouldn't somebody else help them? Or even to say, what do I have to offer? I've got so little. And that's exactly what Jesus is dealing with here. Now, we see in context in verses 12 and above, John had been arrested and now beheaded. And so it's in that light where Jesus is now grieving over his cousin that he pulls away and goes on a solo boat ride from the city of Capernaum to the city of Bethsaida. It's about a 3.5 mile walk, but Jesus goes out in the boat to get away. I don't know how you deal with crisis, but oftentimes that's a very human response, is it not? When crisis happens, I just need to get away for a little bit. Just need to process this. Just kind of go cry it out on the water or whatever. So Jesus goes to do that. And if you look at verse 13, it says, when Jesus heard about John, he withdrew from there in a boat to a secluded place by himself. The people heard it and they followed him on foot. We know he went to Bethsaida because of Luke 9 verse 10 gives us Luke's account of this passage in the story, and they give us that geographic anchor. So we know it's about a 3.5 mile journey. He goes to this place that's called a secluded place. The purpose of the boat trip was to get away, both in the boat and to go to a secluded place. Assumption would be, there ain't nobody there. Problem is, everybody knows where he's going. And it seems like he goes alone. Do you notice that in the text? I don't think the disciples are with him. I think he goes solo. So if Jesus goes out in the boat and you want to know where Jesus is going, who are you going to follow? So here goes Peter and the boys. Peter, probably the guy going, I know the way, everybody, follow me, you know, big dummy. He's trying to be alone, but here's Peter leading the posse to find out where Jesus is. Now, the people go on foot, it says. Now, we're going to find in verse 21 that there's 5,000 people that they count. Now, that's probably 5,000 men. More accurately, that's probably up to 15 to 20,000 people. Now, we hear 20,000 people go, that's a lot of people, but you know, it's not a big deal. No, you need to know about this area. There's nobody there. Like, they're in the northern part of the Galilee in little itty-bitty farming villages, little fishing villages. There would have been people that had to have traveled from all over. They would have come from Capernaum, Chorazin, Gennesaret, Magdala, Tiberias on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. They would have come probably from the other side of the lake as well, or other side of the sea, maybe from the city of Gamla, which was the home of the Zealots, about a 7 mile journey to Bethsaida. The Zealots were the ones who waved palm branches when Jesus came into Jerusalem on the donkey. They probably wanted to come and see, is this really the guy? They probably even came from Hippos. Hippos was about 8 miles from Bethsaida. That was part of the Decapolis. The pagans lived in Hippos. Jesus is gathering now a crowd of 20,000 people of all kinds of different backgrounds. And in verse 14, he sees the multitude. Now, what would you do? Someone just died. You're trying to get alone. You went to a secluded place and you see 20,000 people sitting on the shore. I can tell you what I do. I said, I think I can paddle faster than they can walk. So I'm out of here. No, not Jesus. I want you to notice verse 14. He went ashore, he saw the crowds, and he felt what? Compassion. There it is. That's the key to the whole thing. He felt compassion. I don't know what you feel in times like this, but if you don't feel compassion, it's a heart issue. Jesus felt compassion, and he's going to do something now. He feels compassion for these people, and so he's going to do something for them. And he, in a sense, gets off the boat and goes right back to work. You'll notice, in fact, it says that he healed their sick in verse 14. He's probably still got his feet wet walking off the boat and he's healing their sick. Why? Because his life, he didn't come to be served but to serve. His life is sacrificial generosity. And so he's pouring it out for these people. Why? Because he can. And as he does that, it says evening came, verse 15. The word evening there literally has the idea of late afternoon, early evening. So it's not dark, but it's definitely snack time. Okay, people are going to start looking around wondering if they can drive through Chick-fil-A or something. I mean, they're hungry, but they're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, there's nothing out by Bethsaida, nothing. And so where are you going to go to eat? And so it's starting, people are starting to look around, you know, like, well, what are we going to do here? And they said, this place, verse 15, is desolate, and the hour is already late. And it's the disciples who are saying, they came to him in verse 15, and they say, so send them away that they may go to the villages and buy food for themselves. Send them away. I can't imagine going to Jesus and say, hey, you ought to send these people away. You know, bothering me. But they're focused on them, not the people. There is no compassion yet in the disciples. Now, they'll get it, to their credit, they'll get it, but not yet. Send them away so that they can go get some food. But verse 16, but Jesus has something else in mind. And I'm not sure what they thought when he said this. He obviously, because of verse 14, was so moved with compassion, he's not going to send them away. In fact, he says, look, they don't need to go away. Verse 16, you give them something to eat. And you could just kind of feel the tension. Me? What am I going to give them? I've got like a sack lunch. I mean, what am I going to do? There's like 20,000 people here. I mean, this is not like feeding us. I mean, I've got enough maybe for us, but I don't have enough for them. So we can eat, but you see where this is going. And he says, you give them something to eat. Me? Jesus says, yeah, you. He goes, well, I don't have enough. He goes, well, what do you have? And in verse 17, we find out what they have. Do you see it there? Verse 17, he says, oh man, we got 5 loaves and 2 fish. It's the equivalent of saying, look, I got a PB&J, a juice box, and a Twinkie. That's all I got. And there's 20,000 people. Like, you can break the Twinkie into pretty small pieces, okay? Because I'm pretty sure it's not real stuff anyway. It's all chemically enhanced. So just break little pieces. But it's not going to feed 20,000. That's all they got. And yet what they have, when brought to him, is going to be enough. Look at verse 18. And he says to them, bring them here to me. Whatever you got, just bring it here. And then in verse 19, this jumped out at me. Ordering the people to sit down, he ordered, it's singular, Jesus. He ordered the people to sit. He took the loaves and fish. He looked up to heaven. He blessed them. He broke them. He gave them to the disciples. Who's the hero in the story? He. And yet, here's where it gets really, really fun. Who did all the work? He. He blessed. He was the miracle worker. Now, the guys, you know, like at Sonic, skated around in their rollerblades and handed out, you know, loaves and fish. Okay, they may have passed it out, but he was the one who did it. And the disciples, it says, go and in verse 19, gave them to the crowds. Now, the hero of the story is Jesus. The question I would have for you is, who received the blessing that day? Well, if you look at verse 20, it says they all ate and were satisfied. So did the people receive the blessing? Is that, were they the beneficiaries? Like, that's like, yay, they got the blessing. I don't think so. They ate and were satisfied, but they got a meal. What did the disciples get? They got the blessing. Have you ever seen the face of a child when they open a gift? I mean, is there anything better than that? I mean, just they open up like, oh man, this is awesome. I mean, do you remember? Think back to when you were a kid and you wanted whatever it is you wanted. That you can't even remember what it is now, but you wanted it bad then. And you got it. And you open it up and you looked at mom and dad. You said, you're the best parents ever. This is awesome. I got a G.I. Joe or whatever you wanted. I mean, there's joy in that, isn't there? And as a parent, you give your kids something, you're like, I got you that. That's right. And they open it up. And boy, the joy you feel. Because their excitement, their exuberation, their delight is just passed to you, isn't it? And you just go, yes, that was the blessing. Now, the kid got a toy. Oh, but boy, you're rich. You're rich in the things that are important, in the things that matter. I think what happened, Jesus taught these guys a valuable lesson of the joy that comes when you give your life away. Because as Peter walks to this family group huddled together and he hands them the basket of fish and of crackers or whatever, they're going, this is fantastic. How'd you get this? Dude, you're not going to believe this. He broke them. and multiplied them. There was only two fish or five fish and two loaves. I can't remember which is which. There's like seven pieces of something. And he multiplied them. And it's feeding you. You gotta be kidding me. I know, I'll be right back. He goes and gets another basket. There's some more. It's like, oh, this is the best. They're all high-fiving. This is all. He goes, I know, this is great. And he keeps doing his thing. A fantastic blessing that came back to the disciples. And I think they really received what God wanted them to receive, which is the understanding that life is best enjoyed when you give it away. I think the practical implications of the story are pretty profound, though. Take whatever you have, whether it's much or whether it's little, bring it to Jesus, and then give it away for the betterment of others. I mean, is that not a good way to do life? I mean, think about that for a minute. Take whatever you've got, whether it's a lot or a little, and just bring it to Jesus. He'll bless it, and then you just give it away. Have you ever given something away to somebody? Like, some of my heroes in the faith are just generous people. And they're not big money guys. They're not guys who cut fat checks. They're just generous people. There's something about generous people. Have you noticed that? You just go, that's so fun to be around. I mean, the contrast is also true. Have you ever just hated being around a selfish person? I mean, that's no fun, but boy, the generous. When I go up to Hume Lake, those people understand mountain hospitality. They go, hey, here's my Suzuki, take it. Here's this, take it. If you want to come eat, come eat. Here's some snowshoes, go slide with your girls. I'm just like, that's unbelievable. Thank you so much. Like, how do you communicate? Just thank you. There was a businessman when I went through grad school who had the means, and he supported me a little bit through grad school, through seminary, when I was making nothing. I mean, literally, my check was zero one month. I'm like, oh, honey, we need to pray, you know? And he supported. I go, you know what? Thank you. To be generous. What a blessing that comes from generosity. And Jesus is showing that to them. And you may not have a lot. You may have only a little. It really doesn't matter the quantity. See, that's the neat thing about it. It really doesn't matter the quantity. Take whatever you've got and bring it to Jesus. And then just give it away. And by giving it away, here's what you'll find. Is the blessing returns 100-fold, pressed down and shaken over. Some of you have experienced that. It's the principle of the open or the closed hand. God entrusts you with gifts. How do you hold them? With an open hand or with a closed hand? If you hold them with a closed hand and say they're mine, then you cannot fill that hand anymore because it's already closed. If you hold it with an open hand and say it's yours, and he pours it in there and you distribute it, you give it away and he pours it in there and you distribute it, he's going to keep giving it to you. Now, it's not prosperity gospel. Don't mishear me. I don't say you hold on to it. I say you give it away. All you are is a pipe. You know what a pipe does? Takes fluid from one end, gives it to somebody else. That's all you do. You're just a pipe. So don't buy into the heresy of prosperity gospel, because I think the gospel, ultimately, God promises you peace with God, salvation from sin, no question, persecution and suffering. So Jesus died poor and homeless. We need to remember that. So give it away. If you have the open hand, he'll give you more. Now that principle, they experienced this. Watch what happens. Verse 20. They all ate and were satisfied. And they picked up what was left over of the broken pieces. How many baskets full? 12. How many disciples are there? 12. What did they have for dinner before this miracle? A couple sardines and a couple Ritz crackers. What do they have now? They each have their own lunch pail. They each have their own basket. What's the principle Jesus is saying? Give and it'll be given to you. Pressed down and shaken over. Find a heart of generosity. And I think the disciples learned that principle. And there's a discipleship lesson here. They were involved with the feeding of the 5,000. But what Jesus is showing them is, look, friends, and he told Peter this. He goes, look, I'm going to make you a fisher of men. So there's going to come a time when I'm gone and you're going to be giving not physical food but spiritual food, but you need to remember the pattern. Because if you don't remember the pattern, then you're going to be giving people stuff on your own power and your own energy, and that's going to backfire. The pattern is take whatever you've got, bring it to Jesus, he'll bless it, and then give it away. And he's saying, look, you're going to go feed people spiritually one day, and you're going to reach a point where you realize you don't have any more to give. And you can now muster up your talent and your ability and you can give it in your own strength or you can quit. Or you can bring it to me and I'll multiply it and you can keep going. And I think that's the principle he wanted them to learn. Here's the way this all fits together, by the way. The whole core overflows into being sacrificially generous. But here's what you're going to find as you start talking about generosity. It's going to reveal selfishness in you because it's in all of us. And when it does, what do you do with that? When someone says, hey, Bible talks about tithing, you really ought to consider tithing. And you go, I don't know. And all of a sudden, you got to go back to the core and go, is my heart really the Lord's? Do I really want to submit to what his word says? You're going to come out to the concept of being sacrificially generous, and you're going to feel an opportunity to give to somebody. And you're going to go, yeah, but if I give to them, what about me? And you're going to have to come back to the core and go, man, am I really submitted to God in every area? Do I really care about what his word says about the least of these? And you're going to go back out there. You might break through that wall and say, okay, I'm going to be generous. I'm going to be sacrificially generous. I'm going to wrestle with my flesh. I'm going to give my life away. I'm going for it. And you're going to be an intentional blessing to people. And you're going to find yourself like Schindler. And you're going to take what you've got and you're going to go, but I could have gotten more. I could have gotten one more. I could have done more. And you're going to have to come back to the heart wrecked and go, God, I love you so much, but I can't do it all. And I want to fix everything. I want to feed all of the hungry, and I want to solve all of poverty, but I can't. And he's going to go, okay, keep developing a heart of compassion. Do what you can, filter through my word, and get out there as best you can. He's going to encourage you in that, but it always comes back to the core. This whole thing goes out and back, out and back. If it doesn't come back to the core, then again, we are teaching people to look like and act like Christians. That's a Pharisee. It's got to have the heart. It's got to come from inside. The challenge, I think, for us as we look at this concept is simply this. God has wired us to live life like Jesus, to be like him, who was the ultimate sacrifice of taking what he had and giving it away, constantly giving it away of his time, of his talents, and of his treasures. And by so doing, he changed the world. I think that's the model for us. We're going to have to fight materialism. We're going to have to fight consumerism. We're going to have to fight the assumption, false as it is, that greed will lead to peace or life. And instead have to realize that what God has called us to do is to live unnatural. And that is to take what he's given to us, to give it away. And if we'll give it away, we'll find life. And maybe the yoke of all that which has enslaved us materially will finally be broken when we'll realize it's really not ours to begin with, it's his. So now generosity can become almost like a game. Who can I bless? Who can I be a hope to, a light to? Whose day can I brighten from what I give away? That's where joy is found. Let's pray together. We'll worship. Father, I do thank you for your word that challenges us in areas like this. And though it's difficult for us sometimes to be obedient to these things, I can't help but think that it would be so much fun to try it. And I pray that as we look at the things that you've given us in our time, and in our talents, and in our treasures, that we might get creative together with our friends or our family and begin to ask the question of how could we give it away? How could we be a blessing to the world around? What could we do? To start asking questions like, hey, what if we got together and what if we did this or that and what if we helped this person and what if we took what God gave us and we gave it away? What if? I can't help but think that that would make you proud. And may it happen for us, Lord, from an overflow of the heart. So help us to see that, I pray, and to see the opportunity that we have in Jesus' name. Amen.